How's your car looking? Showing its age? Faded paint? Dents? Dings? Don't worry. Maaco is here to help. They're the experts in affordable paint jobs and light collision repairs, helping you keep your car looking its best without breaking the bank. With Maaco's national reach and community focus, you're not just getting top-notch service. You're actually getting a partner you can trust. Visit your local Maaco today and see how they can refresh your ride. Go in, get the free estimate, and the expert technicians will handle the rest. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Long War Journal. Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Afghanistan, always in the news. However, the Long War Journal's writ is the vast canvas of the Ummah, from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean. We address today immediately Afghanistan, although there is attention now, other parts of the map. Today, East Africa and Al-Shabaab. We begin, however, with the news from Afghanistan. The U.S. has named dates to be out of Afghanistan entirely. The U.S. military putting out a statement last week that it's 95% withdrawn from its military commitment to Afghanistan. At the same time, we have fresh news about a tangle as to who is and who is not eligible to be evacuated at the choice of the Afghan citizen to the U.S. because of threat by the Taliban. You will recall a week past, there was the grim news that a local stand-up comedian, an Afghanistan comedian in and around Kandahar, who at one point had worked for the police sometime in the last 20 years, was taken out of his home and massacred in front of the video camera to intimidate everyone. Since then, we have the fresh news that the State Department and the Biden administration have expanded the eligibility so that it is no longer necessary to prove, if you can, that you work directly for the U.S. government or ISAF. Now you are eligible if you work for a contractor of the U.S. government or ISAF sometime in the last 20 years. Gentlemen, a very good day to you. I begin with your contribution to history, the map. The map you've constructed these many years carefully, district by district, province by province, city by city. We begin with the map today and Bill, your attention to Herat City. Where is it and what does this tell us about the Taliban's pacing and ambitions in these weeks before the U.S. is entirely withdrawn? Good day to you.
Hello, John. Good day as well. Herat city is located in western Afghanistan. It is the third largest city in Afghanistan, and it is also the provincial capital of Herat. It is currently directly under Taliban threat right now. The Taliban is fighting inside areas of the city. The airport has been shut down because the Taliban has been launching attacks. The airport's located in a district south of the city that is currently contested. All but two of the districts in Herat are controlled by the Taliban. Herat City, which is its own district, and the one where the airport is, in Ghazara, is currently contested. Seeing reports of the Taliban fighters inside the city flying their flags, lots of photo ops, photographs and videos of fighting within the city. The Afghan government has sent commandos and special forces to reinforce. This is also, Herat is also the home to the Ismail Khan, the warlord, powerful warlord in western Afghanistan. He and his fighters are pretty much going to have to fight to the death. Victory or death for Ismail Khan. The Taliban has no love for him and his family and his followers. So we're in the midst of a bloody fight in western Afghanistan. Herat City is one of three capitals that are in danger of falling to the Taliban at any point. That also would be Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand, and Kandahar City. In both of those two cities, the Taliban is also inside the city limits and actively fighting Afghan security forces.
Bill, do I remember correctly that Herat is associated entirely with the easy access to Iran across the border, back and forth. And that early, 20 years ago, I can recall being told that it's a separate kingdom within the larger Afghanistan. Does it still function that way as quite distinct from Kandahar or Kabul or Jalalabad?
Yeah, Ismail Khan wields a lot of influence, and he's been sidelined by the government, at least in official capacity. But that doesn't mean he does not wield significant control within Herat. And it is a major point of access to Iran. The border crossing there is currently controlled by the Taliban. So the Taliban are collecting over $1 billion. Well, it takes in about $1 billion plus yearly revenue. The Taliban has controlled that border crossing for about a month now. So they've taken in a significant, and they've reopened it, and they're taxing and collecting that revenue. So it's a direct hit to Ismail Khan's power. Obviously, part of his power is derived via the gun, but part of it is from the money collected at places like the border crossing and taxing from individuals. So when the Taliban controls that crossing, of course, they control the revenue. When the Taliban controls the districts, they control the commerce, the flow of commerce, the taxing, and whatnot. So Ismail Khan is definitely is taking a very big hit by this Taliban offensive in western Afghanistan. And I'm going to reiterate something we've discussed on earlier shows, John. It's a very clever Taliban strategy to go heavy into the north and in the west. They're going after the power brokers. If Ismail Khan is defeated in Herat, then you could expect Forest City and the rest of western Afghanistan to fall to the Taliban in short order. And that takes a major opposition to the Taliban off the table.
Tom, a very good day to you. And I'm keen on your thoughts looking at the map this week. If you can discern a strategy or an overall momentum that is different than encircling Kabul, or is this siege tactics? They're going to take the whole of the periphery of Afghanistan and leave Kabul and the airport in the middle of a crossfire from the bowl. That's what it looks like to my eye. But what do you see happening here, Tom?
I think that's probably about right. Good day, John. I think that basically the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have prioritized certain provincial capitals where they are stronger in the periphery, as Bill has documented for years. And they're tying this noose around these provincial capitals with the hope of tightening those nooses over time, and that's exactly what we're seeing. So far, the Afghan security forces, with the help of American air power, now remember, even though America has almost entirely withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan at this point, we're now seeing increasing indications of American airstrikes to support Afghan forces in these provincial capitals that are under assault. So this is part of the story here. Be that as it may, to date, so far anyway, the Afghan security forces have prevented the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from taking over some of these provincial capitals. But this is a very fluid situation, and that could change at any time.
And I'm looking at the center of the country, outside of Kabul, where government is still maintaining control. Is there any sense that the Afghan National Army is aware of the threat that they're facing? Do they comment about the territory that's being contested or their retreats from these territories? Because my reading of the news, everything comes out of Kabul from the government. I don't hear from the army.
Well, you know, some of the rhetoric we hear out of the Afghan officials, unfortunately, sometimes borders on denial and sort of boasting of their capabilities and pretending that the situation isn't as dire as it is. Look, I understand there's a certain amount of rhetoric is needed to rally the troops and to maintain sort of their moral, basically standing and the fact that they're ready, the morale basically to keep fighting. That's understandable. But sometimes basically the rhetoric we've seen out of Kabul and some of the military officials in Afghanistan is definitely borders on denialism. I think as you can see here, you know, they were caught off guard by, I think, the number of provincial capitals that were assaulted at once, and we're seeing that right now. And I think, as Bill has said from the beginning, they need to prioritize where they're going to stand and fight and what they're going to secure, because if they try and secure the whole country, that could very easily lead them overextended, and it seems that they are overextended at the moment.
I'm speaking to Bill Raggio and Tom Jostin. They have the Long War Journal, a chronicle of the vast canvas of the Ummah. We're concentrating on Afghanistan because there's constant breaking news as the U.S. withdrawal is near completion as to what comes next. I mentioned that we do not have a big picture of how many people are eligible to be evacuated, but certainly that will become a dominant story in these next weeks. We're going to turn to the region next. Other capitals are watching the Taliban's advance at Herat, for example, and the U.S. effort to evacuate thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands from the advancing Taliban. What does this mean to Moscow? What does this mean to Islamabad, to Delhi, to Tehran, and especially the new player in the conversation, Beijing? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jostin of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long Word Journal with their colleagues, and we're watching the Afghanistan story transform itself from a holding action or garrison action by NATO these many years, decades, into one where the Taliban appears to name the battle and identify the field before it attacks and then fade back into the countryside where the Afghan National Army does not demonstrate skill set without U.S. support. At the same time, we're watching this. Moscow, Islamabad, Delhi, Tehran, Beijing are watching it, and the other capitals. So I begin with Moscow. Bill, Moscow wants us to know that it is in constant conversation with Tajikistan, not only at the foreign ministry level, but last week there was a report, or in these last days, that the defense minister of Russia, the Russian Federation, commanding a first-rate military in the region, visited Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan, and plans an outpost at the border, plans military exercises with the Tajik forces, unknown scale of what this exercise will be. Does this surprise anyone, Bill, that Russia is back in the story, back in the game, garrisoning the border with Afghanistan, watching the Taliban?
No, it should not surprise anyone who watches the region. Russia has a vested interest in keeping its presence, its influence within the stands, within Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, particularly that border, Afghanistan. The Russians have a very serious concern about the jihadist threat from Al-Qaeda and its allies, as well as the Islamic State crossing over into the border of the stands and destabilizing these countries. So, again, it's not surprising that Russia is going to seek to reinforce, to support Tajikistan and other countries as the security situation in Afghanistan devolves. The Taliban pretty much control the entire border from Turkmenistan to Uzbekistan to Tajikistan. And while the Taliban, you know, says that it won't allow these foreign groups that operate on its soil to launch attacks and conduct operations in neighboring countries, everyone in the region, the Chinese, the Russians, nobody believes this. And so it's ironic that the Taliban at one point in time was providing weapons and some low-level support to the Taliban operating along the borders in order to try to keep that. The Russians felt they could contain that problem, keep the Taliban on their good side. But, these chickens look like they're coming home to roost, and the Russians are now forced to recommit to increase its support for governments like Tajikistan.
Tom, Pakistan, Islamabad. It's two-faced, I understand, but I have reason to believe that it is also threatened. At the same time, it is the home of the Taliban Pakistan version and the Haqqani network. At this point, Pakistan is not a single player. India is involved, and I wanted to read from a recent essay by a former army commander, an Indian army commander from the Western Command. He writes, Indian priorities should be, one, forge ties with Taliban in discreet manner. Two, convince Taliban and tribal bodies to spare Indian-built infrastructure from destruction. Three, retain goodwill through scholarships and training. 4, safeguard interests of traditional allies, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Ismailis, and Hazaras, all of whom are threatened not only by the Taliban's takeover, but also by the element within ISIS. Tom, is this realistic on India's part? Can it maintain relations with the Taliban over these many years, or is it now going to be vulnerable to a reinvigorated Pakistan terror groups to be attacking India? I can't read this map, Tom.
Well, I think India has a lot to be concerned about when it comes to the jihadis in Afghanistan, because as Bill and I have argued for years, what happens in Afghanistan doesn't stay in Afghanistan. And there are already multiple pieces of evidence showing that jihadis operating in Afghanistan, including Al-Qaeda and its regional wing or regional branch, Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, are very much looking to use the advances in Afghanistan to fuel their jihad in Pakistan, Kashmir, and India, in particular in India. And we've already seen in recent weeks there was a plot by a guy, and very tellingly, his nom de guerre is Umar al-Hammadi, meaning he's from Helmand, Afghanistan, or at least has operated in Helmand, Afghanistan. This plot involved al-Qaeda operatives, alleged al-Qaeda operatives in India who were looking to commit suicide bombings. And this was just broken up in recent weeks. And this is the latest indication that al-Qaeda has already repositioned itself to export more terror to India in the months and years to come.
Bill, back to Herat City, why I found it so significant, your write-up of the Taliban's offensive. I have not seen, and I wonder if the Taliban is boasting about opening conversation with the Islamic Republic of Iran. If India says that it is, if Indian military retires are saying we need to talk to the Taliban, have you seen anywhere that Iran is talking to the Taliban? We know China is. We know Russia's talking about the Taliban. Have you seen anything about Iran, Bill?
Yeah, absolutely. The Taliban have sent high-level delegations to Iran to discuss regional issues within the last several weeks. However, the Iranians have directly supported the Taliban along, particularly along its border. That's one way of extending its influence. There's an IRGC command within Quds Force known as the Ansar Corps, which operates in eastern Afghanistan. Taliban leaders are based there. There's an entire Taliban Shura based out of there. The IRGC has trained Taliban fighters, armed them, given them cash, even paid bounties to have Americans and Westerners and even Afghan police officials and others assassinated. So the Iranians have had an extensive influence campaign and direct support for the Taliban in Afghanistan for well over, for nearly two decades now. So this is nothing new. It's unsurprising that I'm going to be clear, the Iranians and the Taliban, the alliance is complicated, but there's an alliance there nonetheless. The Iranians wanted the United States out of Afghanistan. It's gotten its wish, and now it's going to have to reap the whirlwind that comes from that, because the Taliban historically they've been known to slaughter the Hazara, which are Shia Afghans. So this is something that the Iranians are concerned about. But the Iranian influence, I think, with the Taliban is probably in some ways designed to mitigate that problem, as well as create an alliance with the group that it believes is going to dominate Afghanistan.
Bill Rajo, Tom Jostin, The Long War Journal, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The Taliban, in short, are being treated as if they're the U.S., British, Canadian, and French army marching into Paris in 1944. Celebrate it. This is CBS Eye on the World. We're going to East Africa when we come back. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rajo and Tom Jostin. They keep the Long War Journal for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, where they're senior fellows. The Afghanistan story dominates the news and will for these next weeks, months, and years. However, Al-Qaeda is busy, restless around the world. And this week, Bill and Tom and their Generation Jihad podcast turn to East Africa, Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab is a direct link to Al-Qaeda, but that in itself is a story because it wasn't always clear in the reporting that Al-Shabaab was part of the larger apparatus. So I begin with definitions. Tom, Al-Shabaab, over the years, it has evolved into an effective combat organization, but propaganda organization as well, in many countries in East Africa, reaching into Central Africa. Right now, in your podcast, I learned that Al-Shabaab is learning from the Taliban and learning from propaganda. How so, Tom? What change do you see in their announcements?
Well, what we've documented, and we've got more coming along these lines, is that Shabaab has been cheering on the Taliban's advances in Afghanistan. And interestingly enough, referring to Ayman al-Zawahiri as still alive and referring to him as the emir of al-Qaeda globally, and also honoring Habibullah Akhundzada, the emir of the Taliban, as the commander of the faithful, which is a title that's usually used by a Muslim caliph. Why is this all interesting? Well, Shabaab really has modeled itself after the Taliban and wants to do exactly what the Taliban's doing in Afghanistan. In fact, Bill and I often refer to Shabaab as the Taliban of Africa, or now it's one of two Talibans in Africa, because Al-Qaeda also has a burgeoning emirate in West Africa. And what Shabaab has been fighting to do for years as part of Al-Qaeda is build an Islamic emirate in East Africa that would take over Somalia and would then also take over parts of surrounding countries. And they've made gains in this regard over the last several years. The U.S. has maintained a minimal presence, although that's been drawn down now, was drawn down under President Trump. The U.S. has carried out recently an airstrike in Somalia and seems to still have some presence there in East Africa, of course. But the U.S. presence in Africa has basically helped the Somali government prevent Shabaab from taking over the entire country. It remains to be seen if the U.S. and its allies have the will to keep preventing Shabaab from taking over Somalia in the near future.
I should ask for a definition and an origin story. Bill, I come to you on this. I learned from your podcast something I'd forgotten if I ever knew it, that in the early years and sometime earlier in this century, Al-Shabaab was not clearly linked to Al-Qaeda. Did I hear that correctly? And what was it linked to if it wasn't a bad actor jihadist?
Well, Al-Qaeda's always had a presence in Somalia, and it's influenced some key leaders. Around 2006, a group called the Islamic Courts Union, of which Shabaab was a part, it took over most of central and southern Somalia, including the capital of Mogadishu. And Al-Qaeda was a part of that. There were several key leaders, and there were individuals within Shabaab that wanted to declare allegiance with Al-Qaeda. So to make those be under the cover links, make them official. The African Union, actually Kenya, launched an offensive, ejected the Islamic Court units from Mogadishu and other areas that are controlled, like Baidoa, a major city in west southwestern Somalia. But then Shabaab became the primary actor, and all of the key leaders of the Islamic Court Union joined on with Shabaab. And Shabaab, by 2009, retook control of Mogadishu and all of southern and central Somalia again. And at that point, there was a direct relationship between Shabaab and Al-Qaeda. You even had, and you know, this was something I reported in, I believe, 2010. You had Al-Qaeda, you had Osama bin Laden ordering Sheikh Zubair, who was the leader of Shabaab, to keep the relationship with Al-Qaeda on the down low because bin Laden wanted foreign aid to continue to flow into areas that Shabaab controlled. If it was known that Shabaab was a part of Al-Qaeda's branch, then that would have stopped, or at least been hindered. But then that relationship became, after the death of bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri officially accepted Shabaab as Al-Qaeda's branch. And I believe that was 2011, where Shabaab became an official branch of Al-Qaeda. But all along, it was working in concert with Al-Qaeda to establish. And one other quick point there, you know, that's back to the point that Tom made. Shabaab took control of rural areas to take. It was acting just as the Taliban has acted. and taking control of rural areas to lay pressure on more populated areas. That's what Shabab has done over the past. It's controlled territory. It wants to create its emirate like the Taliban went to create its emirate in Afghanistan. So this is all interlinked. It's all part of the same strategy to get that, to restore the caliphate.
Tom, you mentioned the airstrike. We can guess it was a drone strike by the Biden administration in East Africa against al-Shabaab. I note also in the news, the defense secretary of the United Kingdom, Ben Wallace, and the Kenyan cabinet secretary for defense, Dr. Monica Juma, signed an accord during a visit by the Kenyan official to London. This looks to strengthen the ties between global Britain and Kenya, which is a traditional Anglophone country. However, this reminds me that other countries are involved in this, whether they want to be or not, from a list that is presented in an announcement, I believe from al-Shabaab, that you feature on your podcast. And most striking on the list is that al-Shabaab either opposes or is in conflict with Turkey. Did I hear that correctly, Tom?
That's right, John. You know, Turkey is one of the issues where there's a divide within the jihadi world in terms of relations with Turkey, because Turkey has supported international efforts in Somalia and is invested in international efforts in Somalia that are opposed to Shabaab's takeover of the country. And so Shabaab and its emir, Amin Amar, who we've talked about quite a bit, otherwise known as Abu Obeidah, has railed against Turkey on several occasions in Shabaab's official propaganda and official media. The issue is that other parts of the Al-Qaeda web and ISIS, too, have benefited from Turkey's largesse. In fact, the United States just last week issued a number of sanctions by the Treasury Department and the State Department targeting Al-Qaeda and ISIS figures who use Turkey and have safe haven in Turkey and use that safe haven to raise funds and direct funds to the jihad. So this is a very complicated issue in terms of how Turkey sits on this divide within the jihadi world.
Also, Qatar is named. In fact, al-Shabaab has what you'd have to say is an unusual and original list of enemies. The puzzle here, Tom, always is how al-Qaeda works. It seems to have almost a federal style, whereas the individual regional al-Qaeda representatives have their own understanding of what we need to do and how we're going to do it. And al-Qaeda doesn't override that. It takes advantage of it. So should we think again of al-Qaeda as a franchisor that provides independent decision-making to the region, al-Shabaab?
You know, I don't like the word franchise because it's true that al-Qaeda allows the regional branches a large discretion when it comes to decision-making within their own regional branches. But that decision-making has to take place inside a framework that al-Qaeda is establishing. It's probably true that could be likened to a franchise business model. The problem is, however, that some of the individuals who are in these branches are in fact members of the senior al-Qaeda leadership as well. So it's like basically some of the home corporate headquarters has some of its members in these branches. Like there are people in Shabaab today who are almost certainly part of al-Qaeda's senior leadership. We've documented that across the board. So there's not this clear dividing line really between al-Qaeda's senior leadership and the regional branches. In fact, it's much more organic and there's much more of a continuum between the two.
Bill, al-Shabaab, do I remember correctly that over the years, the Obama administration and the Trump administration, although my memory is not as vivid, launched routinely airstrikes, so much so that you were keeping a record at one point of airstrikes year to year. And suddenly that was cut back. Was that cut back with a policy statement, or did the attention of the Trump administration just turn elsewhere? Do we know?
So the Trump administration, before it left office, it decided to draw down the number of troops. There was about 700 troops supporting the Afghan or the Somali government. And then President Trump wanted to get them out and deploy them into Djibouti and do what they call over the horizon strikes. So the strikes haven't ended, but this is part of the Trump administration's efforts to disengage from the war. But the fact that the U.S. continues to have to launch these strikes is a key indication that the problems in Somalia don't go away when the U.S. leaves. So the endless wars don't end when the U.S. withdraws from these countries. The wars continue. So it's, you know, as much as the Trump administration wanted to disengage from Somalia, he still allowed the capacity to launch strikes to support the Somali government. But, as U.S. military commanders and officers in the region have noted, the further back you get, to launch these strikes, the further away, the more distance you put yourself between the location where you're conducting the strike and where you're actually launching them from, the more difficult it is to conduct accurate and timely strikes and more impactful strikes.
And the puzzle is why the strikes, Bill? If we're not committing to Afghanistan, why would we commit to East Africa? Can you discern a U.S. strategy in these strikes? What do we get? We get a request from the locals, and then we process it with some unknown checklist, and then we send out very expensive drones to conduct a strike. Is that how it works?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, the U.S. Special Forces and U.S. Air Force are going to work closely with trusted Somali counterparts to launch these attacks. The targets typically either are members of Shabaab that are considered to be a threat to the West, but often, more often than not, these strikes are launched at what we would call military targets for Shabaab. Like, I'll often see them take out technicals, or attack Shabaab, training camps or ammunition depots. So they're actually targeting Shabaab's military assets, not what is often called external, operations assets or assets that are used to conduct attacks against the U.S., the West, or Western interests. And it's just an indication that without these strikes, the Somali government and military would be far more vulnerable. The strikes have certainly tapered off, but then it is also difficult to know when the strikes are being conducted by the military, which they're often announced, or if they're being conducted in support of the CIA, and the CIA is not under any obligation to disclose these strikes.
Bill Rajo, Tom Jostin, they're senior fellows for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Al-Qaeda always in the news. And when we come back, Tom's written up fundraisers in Turkey. Al-Qaeda's strength is its ability to raise money. Just like any other bad actor in the world, you've got to finance your troops. How? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jostin and Bill Rajo, the senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, who keep the Long War Journal. Afghanistan, much in the news, but Al-Qaeda never far out of it. Al-Qaeda and Taliban are integrated and are on the eve of what is presented as a great success. This translates into Al-Qaeda's other branches taking credit for or advancing in similar fashion by the Taliban. Does it also translate into raising money? Tom, you've written up an announcement by the U.S. Treasury about Al-Qaeda fundraiser and banking information out of Turkey. Is this fresh information to Treasury, or is this business as usual for how Al-Qaeda worked over the years? Is there any change in the face here?
Well, John, there's some new details on what the Treasury Department and State Department revealed last week, and they identified a figure in Turkey, Hassan al-Shaban, who's been basically funneling money from al-Qaeda from all the way from North America, interestingly enough, and throughout Africa and elsewhere to the so-called Mujahideen in Syria. And he's been doing this for some time, and he has been basically what the Treasury Department says is that his account information, his banking information, was provided to al-Qaeda members as a safe port for them to send their money to make sure it went to the right sources. So this is pretty interesting. There are other figures who were identified by the Treasury Department last week as well. But this is part of a longstanding pattern now. The Treasury Department in particular has identified Turkey as a logistical hub for ISIS. while also identifying members of Al-Qaeda, who of course are opposed to ISIS, as operating in Turkey as well. And this logistical hub is used to supply funds to jihadists, transfer personnel, move supplies. The Treasury Department's identified procurement agents, for example, for ISIS who live and operate in Turkey. And at one point, the Treasury Department also identified the former finance emir for Mosul, which of course was one of the two de facto capitals for the Islamic Caliphate. Basically identified this individual as someone who had moved to Turkey after the fall of Mosul. And they did this, the U.S. did this in conjunction with the Iraqi government, basically trying to put pressure on Turkey to, basically end his safe haven and crack down on him. And this speaks to a longstanding story here, John, where Turkey really is in a lot of ways similar to Pakistan. It's a duplicitous American ally. Unlike Pakistan, it's actually a member of NATO, which is a problem, we would say in the long run. Turkey has, basically adopted this posture where it's often in bed with extremists and jihadists who are on its side of various conflicts. And, they are in fact opposed to the U.S. and its allies on the other side of those conflicts. So this is a big problem.
And do we see any change in Al-Qaeda's method of raising money, or is this the same thing we started learning 20 years ago? It features a global headline and then passes the hat. Is it the same as ever, Tom?
You know, it's funny, John. I often get asked for insight into what Al-Qaeda's budgets look like or how much money they're raising. And the simple truth of the matter is no one really knows. We only get snippets of information here and there. We do know that Al-Qaeda's branches in Somalia and West Africa, Yemen and elsewhere, they do raise money through local taxation from the territory they control. They have multiple streams of revenues that they use, including from donors and from other unsuspecting sources. But nobody really knows what the total budget looks like or where all the sources of flows are coming from. The information we got last week indicates, however, that this is a fairly advanced and significant financial network that's being operated out of Turkey and is pooling funds from multiple sources to go into Al-Qaeda's coffers.
Yes, you cannot run a global terror outfit without cash. Bill, I come back to you because always checking. The Taliban over these many months and years has been careful to leave out Al-Qaeda in its announcements and to deny always that Al-Qaeda is involved in its successes. Does that continue? Was there any interruption in these last weeks, Al-Qaeda leaking through the Taliban's success?
Yeah, the Taliban continues to maintain that there's no foreign fighters in Afghanistan and that it doesn't provide shelter to Al-Qaeda or other foreign jihadists. We all know that's not true. The Afghan military frequently reports on the killing of Al-Qaeda fighters, particularly in southern Afghanistan, in Helmand and Kandahar provinces. The Taliban has done a very good job at keeping this under wraps and convincing Western reporters and Western officials that it isn't supporting, you know, that it doesn't, that its relationship with Al-Qaeda is non-existent. But even the United Nations in its recent report noted that the Taliban or Al-Qaeda is operating in at least 15 provinces. This is something Tom and I have documented in numerous times at various points. This is from Al-Qaeda's own propaganda. So Al-Qaeda itself, it's kind of, it can't contain its glee. But since this is being issued in Urdu, no one's picking up on the fact that, other than sources like the United Nations, is really picking up on these deep, deep ties between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
And Tom, just making certain, is it still the case in Washington that the withdrawal from Afghanistan does not strengthen Al-Qaeda's hand in the whole region? Is that still the narrative?
You know, I think that basically you could find that there are contradictions in the narrative coming out of Washington. On the one hand, you have senior American officials, including President Biden, wanting to say that Al-Qaeda is degraded and therefore we can leave Afghanistan and not have to worry about it. On the other hand, you hear these reports that there's going to be this quick Al-Qaeda resurgence if the Taliban is successful in basically winning the war in Afghanistan. What Bill and I have argued all along is it's not about an Al-Qaeda resurgence. They've been there for years. They've been there the entire time. And the U.S. has consistently underestimated their presence in Afghanistan. It's one of the main problems in the war in Afghanistan is that the U.S., after all these years, couldn't provide a rigorous
intellectually sound intelligence estimate of what Al-Qaeda looks like and how it operates in Afghanistan and the surrounding countries. So basically this is one of these issues where this isn't about Al-Qaeda making a comeback in Afghanistan. They've been there for years. And what you're going to find after, in the coming months, we suspect, if the Taliban is successful in taking over more territory, including provincial capitals in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda is going to acknowledge in a more robust way its presence and what it's been doing. We've been following their literature in Arabic, for example, their weekly newsletter. They advertise they're taking part in operations on behalf of the Taliban on a very regular basis.
Tom Jossen, a senior fellow, Bill Rajo, a senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, both senior editors for the Long War Journal, The Taliban on the Offensive. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to the Wealth Break Podcast, a real conversation about finance.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone.
I feel like sometimes being broke is a cycle and that we might have to revisit that.
And we're not stopping at success stories.
What happens when it doesn't go right? How do you cope with it?
Because wealth isn't just about money. It's about creating a life where you thrive and help others do the same.
Listen to the Wealth Break Podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life